Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Leading off today on The Brian Lehrer Show, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne asked, what kind of capitalism do we want in light of this week's Obama-Cory Booker exchange over Bain Capital and the flameouts by J.P. Morgan Chase and the Facebook IPO? E.J. also has a new book called Our Divided Political Heart, and he's coming up in 60 seconds right after this appeal to all you official members of the Procrastinators Club. Congratulations. You have waited until the last day of the pledge drive to get your pledge in. Your membership in the Procrastinators Club is in good standing and secure, but it's okay because the rules allow you to be both a member of the Procrastinators Club and WNYC. We know you've been meaning to do it, but the deadline is now. The drive ends today. And I can now announce that we are in our final matching period of the drive. That means every dollar that you pledge right now will also be matched by another 50% of your pledge by a group of WNYC members who have pooled some extra contributions. Love this member match because it's not about one wealthy benefactor. It's members like you at regular levels who kick in a little extra above their membership dollars to create this fund. So let's take advantage of their generosity and see what yours is as a charter member of the Procrastinators Club and hopefully a 2012 member of WNYC. 1-888-376-WNYC is the number to call. 1-888-376-9692 or pledge online at WNYC.org. Thank you all for doing it on this final day of the drive. And there is this one final match for 50% above what you pledge. So please help us take advantage of that and do what you can to support the station. Thank you all so much as the drive is wrapping up. Now to Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. You hear him Fridays opposite David Brooks on All Things Considered. His new book is called Our Divided Political Heart. Hi, E.J. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, I love being on your show. I particularly appreciate your having me in on the book. And I got to say, I identify fully with all of the members of the Procrastinators Club. I can relate to that.
Having a column deadline twice a week, right?
Yeah, so that I can't procrastinate on.
Driving your editors crazy. Where's that EJ column? Can I start with your column this week titled, What Kind of Capitalism Do We Want? We had the Obama-Cory Booker exchange over Bain Capital. And as I said, the flameouts by J.P. Morgan Chase and the Facebook IPO, you somehow see those all raising related questions?
Right. I think, and I talk about this some in the book, actually, from the beginning of our republic, we have argued about what kind of economy we want, what kind of capitalism do we want, because there isn't just one kind of capitalism. And I think the argument over Bain, if carried out right, could be very instructive, because if you look at Romney's career, there are areas where, as a private equity guy, he really operated something like a venture capitalist and provided money for companies that worked, like Domino's or Sports Authority. And those are the ones he wants to brag about, and it's fine for him to brag about that. But there are other aspects of Bain's business and other aspects of modern capitalism that bother a lot of people, not just critics of capitalism, but even people who defend the system. Is it a great idea to load companies up with debt in takeover deals? Can that make the company go out of business? Are there problems with people who invest making tons of money even when the government fails? Are there problems with their pulling all the money out of a pension system, which in a sense breaks faith with employees who have worked for a company for a long time? And I think if we examine Bain, we're going to see the varieties of capitalist behavior, if you will. And that'll be a good thing for us to argue about. And similarly, obviously, the J.P. Morgan case and the Facebook IPO says that you can't have capitalism without rules. Rules sound nicer than regulations, but they're the same thing. And that if we didn't have an SEC, for example, people wouldn't know that they weren't buying watered stock. That's why we put it in place. So we're going to argue about what kind of rules capitalism needs to work. And I think on the whole, this is a good thing, which is why I don't think Governor Romney is going to get around the Bain debate. I think he's better off engaging in it.
So let me play the sequence of clips about Bain. We'll hear part of an Obama campaign ad that sort of started it. Newark Mayor Cory Booker's criticism of it on Meet the Press on Sunday and President Obama's defense the next day. The campaign spot first, or a 15-second excerpt from it, featuring voices of workers from a company bought by Bain.
To get up on national TV and brag about making jobs when he has destroyed thousands of people's careers, lifetimes, just destroying people.
He's running for president, and if he's going to run the country the way he ran our business, I wouldn't want him there.
So those workers' characterizations of Mitt Romney. Now, Cory Booker.
This kind of stuff is nauseating to me on both sides. It's nauseating to the American public. Enough is enough. Stop attacking private equity. Stop attacking Jeremiah Wright. This stuff has got to stop.
Nauseating, Mr. President? Irrelevant to the real issues?
The reason this is relevant to the campaign is because my opponent, Governor Romney, his main calling card for why he thinks he should be president is his business experience. Yeah, he's not going out there touting his experience in Massachusetts. He's saying, I'm a business guy, and I know how to fix it, and this is his business. And when you're president, as opposed to the head of a private equity firm, then your job is not simply to maximize profits. Your job is to figure out how everybody in the country has a fair shot.
So, E.J. Dionne, there's a lot to unpack in those three clips. But President Obama wants us to get the distinction that he's trying to make between running a successful business, Bain, as an example of how a president could create jobs, and how it's an example of how a president would be focused on too narrow a vision.
Right. Well, I think from the very beginning, if Mitt Romney had not claimed throughout his campaign that his experience as a businessman, and a lot of that experience was at Bain Capital, if he hadn't claimed that's what qualifies him to be president at this difficult time, maybe it would be more problematic for the Obama campaign to open up this issue. But it's Romney who opened up the issue. And so I think it's perfectly fair to judge. If he wants to be judged as a businessman and what he did, let him be judged by that. And I think it's absolutely true that being a political leader is different from being the leader of a company. And in terms of this argument about capitalism, one of the things I talk about in my book is how we've had this argument for a long time. Teddy Roosevelt criticized unregulated and purely individualistic industrialism. And Woodrow Wilson, it sounded like Woodrow Wilson was at one of the Occupy demonstrations. He warned that we were nearing, and I quote, the time when the combined power of high finance would be greater than the power of government. It's almost as if Woodrow Wilson anticipated Citizens United. And so I just disagree with Mayor Booker. He backed very far away from those comments on Rachel Maddow's show the next day. But Mayor Booker's had a lot of friends on Wall Street for a long time. And I think that was his first instinct. But I just think it's a mistake to say this is not a legitimate issue. It is. There are demagogic ways you can talk about it, but I don't think asking questions about what Bain did is at all illegitimate.
One interesting thing to me was Booker in that clip equating the Obama spot about Bain Capital with the Republicans considering equating Obama with Jeremiah Wright. Going after Bain is questioning what kind of capitalism we want to have. The other is a racially coded fiction that tries to tell Americans that you think you know who Barack Obama is after 4 years as president, but don't believe your own eyes. He may act like Barack Obama, but he's really Bobby Seale.
Amen. I couldn't agree more. And I think that, you know, in one case, Romney really is making this central to his identity. Barack Obama has never said that his presidency hangs on his relationship with Jeremiah Wright. And you're right, it's full of coded messages. And I don't know if Mayor Booker regrets that or not. I think politically he may now, but I just think it's very, very unfortunate that he said that.
E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Our Divided Political Heart, and we'll get explicitly into the book more as we go. But to stay on a related question for a minute. In the parade of horribles in your column, J.P. Morgan Chase, the Facebook IPO, and the Bain debate, you didn't include Greece on the brink yet again. And I was very interested in something that you said to David Brooks on All Things Considered last week when you were both on, that you have strong feelings about whether government failed Europe to cause the crisis there or whether capitalism did. And I think we casually assume that it was government. Do you think it was capitalism more than the expansive welfare state?
Well, why are we in this downturn? Why do all of these governments face this financial crisis? There are governments that were quite fiscally responsible in Southern Europe that are nonetheless facing a huge crisis now. And that's because of the downturn. That's because abuses in the financial system created the crash of 2008 and sort of again 2009. Doesn't mean you don't have to talk about the long-term future of welfare states in Europe. But as long as the economy was growing, as long as the economy was producing tax revenue, you didn't have this level of crisis. So that I think everybody wants to turn it on the welfare, the European welfare state, and act as if no one in Southern Europe works for a living. When I lived in Italy for a couple of years as a correspondent, I could tell you that's not true. And so I do think it's a way of evading the problems that were caused within capitalism by the abuses that went on for a decade before the crash.
And I think that goes to the heart of your book, Our Divided Political Heart. We saw it in the USA Today polling analysis released this week. We had Susan Page on to talk about it. Obama supporters are worried about health care and retirement savings. Romney supporters are more worried about the federal debt and therefore the size of government. So do you see that as representative of the divide your book is about?
Right. In a funny way, the divide I talk about in the book is also what unites us. I argue that from the very beginning of our country, Americans have been torn by a deep tension between our love of individualism and our reverence for community, and that America works best when we keep these two things in balance. And I think at our best, we balance the local, the national, the individual and the communal, the economic, the civic, the public and the private, and that we are at a moment in our politics when I think one side of the debate in particular, the conservatives, whom I write of quite respectfully in the book, I respect the long conservative tradition, but I think conservatism has been taken over by a kind of radical individualism, which is trying to rewrite our history as if communitarian sentiments never mattered, as if government did not matter in the growth of our country from the beginning. One of the things I like to point out is that the first federal health care program was socialized medicine for seamen, for folks who went to sea, the Federal Marine Hospital System. That was signed into law in 1798. Mm. And yet I don't see any record of protests against Adams Care. It was signed by President John Adams. So I think what we're looking for is a balance. And I think we're very worried about national decline right now. And I think the way out of that decline is to refresh the traditional American balance between public and private, the individual and the community.
So hold that thought. And after the break, we'll dig into it further with E.J. Dionne, his book, Our Divided Political Heart. We'll talk more about that rise of what he calls radical individualism and much more. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue now with Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. His new book is called Our Divided Political Heart. E.J., in your book, you write about the rise of radical individualism in the country and especially in the Republican Party. This is where we left off before the break, and I said we would dig into this a little more. We've always had a strong individualist streak in the American spirit. It's part of what makes America America. So what is today's radical individualism as you see it, and how is it different?
Well, I think traditional American individualism is a tempered individualism because it's always tempered by the notion that rights come with responsibilities, as we often say, a regard for the community as a whole, And going back to the very beginning of the Republic, we were defined by two sets of ideas. On the one side, yes, we are proudly individualistic. There's a kind of Ben Franklin self-improving stream of individualism. There's also a Walt Whitman kind of self-realization stream of individualism. Maybe you could say a capitalist and a hippie version. But there are also streams of, if you will, communitarianism or community feeling. There's a strong biblical tradition that goes back to the Puritans. I'm sorry. And there is a small r Republican tradition that says that caring about the common weal is essential to self-government. We are all of those things at once. And I think what's happened, particularly with the rise of the Tea Party, is that our friends in the Tea Party really want to define America solely in terms of that emphasis on individual liberty. They don't want to talk about civic obligations. They don't want to talk about the ways in which government has contributed to national well-being. And at the risk of sounding like I'm joining your pledge campaign, I was thinking as I heard the pledge that public radio is a classic American invention because it competes in a vigorous radio marketplace. It gets very modest support from government, but its primary support comes from a community of people who give voluntarily. That's the kind of thing that Tocqueville admired about America, our ability to build these partnerships and to reflect both sides of our character. And so I think my book actually takes issue with Tea Party history of the Tea Party's history of America, but I honor them at the beginning and say I agree with them that it's very important to look to our roots, but then let's have a look at what our authentic roots really are. And so my book is partly a historical answer to their historical argument.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls for E.J. Dionne. You probably hear him weekly on All Things Considered, see him on Meet the Press, etc. Maybe read him in his syndicated column. And his new book is called Our Divided Political Heart. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to talk to E.J. on the air, 212-433-9692, or post a question or comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So to follow up on what you just said, I'm curious what you think the deepest roots of the drift toward radical individualism are. You know, when there's a crime or when there's a crime wave, crime in society, liberals look for root causes, not just personal responsibility. When there's family breakdown, you look for root causes. What wasn't working about marriage in America or whatever. So if we assume the radical individualism of the Tea Party Republicans didn't spring from nowhere, what do you see as its roots?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge, and I do acknowledge in the book, that this is a kind of radical individualism has always been one stream within conservatism. And there is really one period in our history where it predominated, and that would be the Gilded Age after the Civil War, running, say, from the 1860s. I would date it to ending when Theodore Roosevelt became president in 1901. So it's always been around there. And it was an important piece of conservative opposition to the New Deal. And you heard some of it in Barry Goldwater's rhetoric. But radical individualism within conservatism was always checked by a strong communitarian streak. One conservative I've always admired is Robert Nisbet, who taught at Columbia for a while, who wrote the book called The Quest for Community. And there were communitarian conservatives and compassionate conservatives who said, yes, we honor individualism, but we know there are other obligations. And I think conservatism went haywire in recent years, both with the failures of the Bush presidency and with the rise of Barack Obama. I think a lot of conservatives wanted, after the second President Bush was widely seen as a failure, to separate themselves from his legacy. And they weren't about to argue that he was too conservative. So they said he was a big government conservative, even if a lot of the spending was in Iraq and Afghanistan and not here, and that compassionate conservatism was a terrible mistake. And then Obama, I think in many ways, is at least as much, maybe more, a communitarian as he is a liberal. So I think this pushed conservatives further into that camp. And then lastly, I think you've seen the rise of a particular kind of big business conservatism empowered by the Citizens United decision and a total opening up of the campaign system to large sums of money. And I think the business community has moved away from where it used to be. which was itself a kind of temperate individualism. They understood a kind of the strong community role they had to play, and they moved more and more toward let's look out for ourselves. So I think all these factors push conservatism away from the respect for community they used to have and toward an individualistic spirit that I think is antithetical to the long history of American conservatism.
212-433-WNYC with E.J. Dionne. Deborah in Newark, you're on the air. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hey. I think what we're talking about, Mr. Dionne, I consider your radicalized individualism to be a very genteel, polite way of making reference to pathological selfishness, economically driven. It has been a long time since American economics has in the least bit resembled, American capitalism has resembled Adam Smith. We're more in the model of Malthusian economics, where only the very fittest survive economically, and all others are allowed to fall away. And what we have here is a clash of visions of humanness, of what does it mean to be a human on the planet, a clash of values and worldview. And what has reigned ascendant in the past half century is that of utter selfishness.
Deborah, thank you. And EJ, you laughed, but what do you think of her?
Oh, no, I was actually grateful to Deborah because I think that's the first time in a long time I've been called genteel, so I appreciate it. And in some level, I don't disagree with Deborah because I do think that this era's radical individualists, as I call them, really do look back to that Gilded Age when social Darwinist survival of the fittest ideas really defined, among other things, a whole series of Supreme Court decisions that I write about, including the decision that declared corporations as people, decisions that said, no, you couldn't regulate the working hours of people. Those were eventually overturned, the Lochner decision, for example. And so I do think that radical individualism does become pathological if it's not checked with a concern for others. And if you care about preserving liberty, which I think we all do across the American political spectrum, you have to understand that this is a common project. So I appreciate her call.
But isn't it also about competing notions of individual and community, not just individual versus community? Liberals see community in a national sense that has a role for government, helping individuals retain their autonomy, their individualism through their lives. Conservatives think of community more in terms of church or family. Maybe you saw the Campbell Brown knock on Obama in the New York Times this week, saying it doesn't just take a government, it takes family, church or family, and see government as taking from their deserving communities to give to undeserving ones. So do you see this at all in terms of competing notions of community?
I think you're absolutely right about that way the debate is framed, and I talk about that quite a lot in the book. I think that that is a kind of false choice sort of debate. Because if you look at the federal government's role historically, our conservative friends basically say it always disempowers the family, the government does. It always disempowers community. I just think that's flatly wrong from our history. If you look at a program like the National Service Program, the Corporation for National Service, this uses federal dollars to help all kinds of local groups, including, by the way, churches, to maintain themselves. Our federal policies can be friendly to the family or not friendly to the family. We have a tax code that I think might even be more usefully more friendly to the family, but we do give support to people raising children. So that this is an area where I think that if we pretend that it's national and local are enemies, that's just not the case. Theda Skocpol, a great scholar, points out that some of our strongest local organizations were national federations that often pursued federal policies that strengthened their local bodies as well as their national bodies. And that's, I want to sort of encourage a kind of dialogue among advocates of community across these lines. And I think conservatives need to acknowledge more that the federal government is not a disempowering entity.
John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with EJ Dionne. Hello. John, are you there?
Oh, hi. How you doing? I think there's kind of a misrepresentation going on here. I feel like that what really Tea Party is about is making the message that not only that individualism is important, but it also leads to community. and that if you were to put the community onto the people, if you were to force policies and things, this is no, it becomes a hierarchy. And then there's people who are succeeding within the system and people without, and there's no opting out. There's no volunteer part of the system anymore. And that's the real fear, is that we'll lose our liberties through, you know, health care, through where we're no longer, we'll limit our choices.
EJ?
I do think that's the disagreement we have, and John and I may just disagree on that. For example, I don't view, say, Medicare and Social Security as either a threat to liberty. I actually see Medicare and Social Security as expanding people's liberty. We have a healthcare system that is more and more expensive, and that many, many working Americans simply will not be able to afford healthcare unless we create a somewhat more collective system. I know you're not supposed to use the word collective in America, but Social Security is a collective retirement system. Medicare is a collective healthcare system. And yes, I agree that I think his characterization of the Tea Party is right, which is they view all these things as leading us down a road to serfdom, as Hayek put it. But I think history tells us that's simply not true. That is part of the argument I'm making in the book.
John, thank you for your call. But to expand on that, the Republicans talk about freedom. We hear that word a lot in the presidential campaign, equals individual. And the Democrats talk about fairness equals community. But what do you think about how the Republicans seem to own the word freedom in our national conversation? Romney talks about Obama health reform, just like the caller, limiting our freedom. George Bush fought the Iraq War under the label of a freedom agenda worldwide. Democrats don't seem to use the word all that much. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's unfair. The very notion of liberalism way back in the beginning was all about freedom. And liberals have always advocated the rights of individuals against an oppressive government. The slogan of the civil rights movement was freedom now. And I do think it's useful to go back to some of the speeches and sermons of the civil rights years in talking about freedom. But the liberals, I think, and progressives see freedom as depending upon a strong community. They see freedom as depending upon community action and involvement. And so I do think they've let the word freedom go. And the reason I talk about our divided political heart is I don't think you can talk about Americans apart from our love of both of these things, individual liberty and a desire for a strong functioning community. And so I hope the book encourages liberals to speak in both terms. But surely there's something wrong if liberals let conservatives have a monopoly on the word freedom.
Christine in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with EJ Dion. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that, you know, this is one of the things that bothers me the most when I watch the discussion about Bain Capital or just what goes on politically, is that capitalism, it seems to me as though you're, by the Republican definition, you're either a capitalist or you're a socialist. And it seems to me that the best type of capitalism that works the best, particularly in America, is a mixture of different philosophies, which is overall capitalistic, but also has other, you know, socialistic philosophy, socialism type philosophies. The teachers' union is a socialist sort of way of guaranteeing rights for teachers. Social Security, all those things, and it seems as though you're either one or the other, and they don't accept the fact that we just can't be a purely capitalistic society. Now, I say that as a liberal, but there have been many Republicans I would have voted for over the last 30 years, but they have been so tarred and feathered by the other side that they never get a chance to run.
Christine, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. And you write, I think, in your column this week, EJ, about the idea of a social marketplace or a social capitalism, which does sound to some people like a paradox, like a contradiction.
Right. I was grateful for the caller. I want to vote for her. I think she'll like the book. And in particular, mentioning some Republicans, Jacob Javits, actually, the former senator from New York, plays an important role in my book because he talks about the roots of the Republican Party as the party of national action. And he goes back to Hamilton and Clay and Lincoln, which I think is a very important piece of Republicanism that Republicanism has pushed aside. But you're right. I do talk about the social market, which is a term that comes out of the Christian Democratic movement in Germany and really reflects what both the Christian Democrats and Social Democrats in a lot of countries have fought for. It's the idea that, yes, we know market economies produce goods and services in a way that can be quite efficient. I don't know anyone in the world, perhaps the North Korean government, that wants to organize economies along old Soviet lines. But we accept that the market needs to be tempered. It needs to be tempered by controlling excessive concentrations of private power. It needs to be tempered because we need rules to guarantee that the products we buy are safe, including food and drugs. And we need rules to protect people against abuses in the marketplace. Lastly, we need rules because the market doesn't necessarily always produce just outcomes. And we don't want people sitting out there absolutely impoverished if there's an economic downturn.
So
that's why I like the combination of the term a social market. We can have both. And that's why I really do appreciate that caller's
comment. So if that's a plea for moderation, in our last minute, I want to note that you write with great hope about the millennial generation in this book, Today's Young Americans Born After 1980. And one thing you attribute to them is moderation, balance and moderation, which we usually think of as signs of wisdom achieved with age. On what do you see this moderation among millennials, and why would wisdom spring from youth and not age today?
Which happened before in our history. And I salute that. I'm so sorry. I salute that generation because I think they combine a moderate spirit with a broadly progressive outlook. This is a generation that has done service at a rate that we haven't seen in other generations. They believe in government's possibilities, but they also have a certain skepticism and they want it to work better. It's no accident that this group voted so heavily for Barack Obama, because I think that was the promise of his 2008 campaign. And if I can close on something, we hear a lot these days that somehow China is going to run ahead of us because they are a very efficient nation. A lot of that was said about fascist countries in the 1930s, and we proved them wrong. And there's a writer for the Financial Times called Richard McGregor who wrote, right as I was finishing the book, America's problem is not that it does not work like China. It is that it no longer works like America. And I think the book is about discovering what working like America means and about how we protect liberty by fostering the sense of fellowship that liberty requires. And I think it's by reaffirming and refreshing this balance that we can get out of our polarization and all our fears of decline.
E.J. Dionne, his new book is called Our Divided Political Heart. He'll be in New York to discuss the book in person, by the way, tomorrow night. It is a ticketed event. It costs money to get in. But if you're interested, it's at the Players Club on Gramercy Park South tomorrow night at 7. So contact the Players Club, I guess, if you're interested in that. And, of course, you can hear E.J. Dionne on All Things Considered every Friday and read his column in The Washington Post and syndicated. E.J., really good conversation. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you always.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. A lot more to come.